It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to have you with us wherever you are in Southern California or listening around the world, kpcc.org or the KPCC app. Joining us this week are critics Tim Cockshell of Alt Film God and CineGods.com and Amy Nicholson, host of the Canon Podcast. We begin with the horror thriller A Quiet Place. Emily Blunt and John Krasinski star. Krasinski is also the director of the film and the co-screenwriter with Brian Woods and Scott Beck. Amy, what'd you think of A Quiet Place?
Yeah, John Krasinski, who most people know as Jim from The Office, has made a pretty nasty little horror film starring him and his wife as parents. They're parents in real life, they're parents in this film. And it's a story about two parents trying to keep their family alive in a world where if they make any sound, a cough, these giant, pretty generic-looking, slithery monsters will just dart out of nowhere and devour them whole. A Quiet Place has a pretty terrific introduction when you're learning how this whole world works. The kids are tiptoeing around barefoot in a grocery store, trying to get the littlest kid not to pick up a toy with batteries and flashing lights. And then the more...
So we kind of begin in this world right off the bat?
Oh, yeah. There's almost little dialogue, and what it is whispered. You know, it's a very, very quiet film, which is effective for horror films, especially if you're going to do the kind of cheap thing Krasinski pulls a couple times where you have a really loud noise outside. I felt like the more you watch this film, the less it made sense.
I'll say. This film is what I like to call concept smart, but content dumb. And the concept really is fantastic.
Yeah, it's a great concept. Yeah.
Lovely. I wonder what this film might have been like if, say, Hitchcock, who didn't really make horror movies, or Polanski had same concept. For one thing, Polanski and Hitchcock would have gotten rid of all the dumb. And just about everything that happens in this movie is absolutely moronic. If we accept the conceit that these giant ear monsters will eat your children, you know what I'm going to do? Keep an eye on the children. These children wander around everywhere. They're picking stuff up, knocking stuff down. I think I'd get rid of everything in my house that could possibly fall down. There's an opening scene.
I don't really believe you'd be able to pull off any of that, by the way.
I try. These people plainly haven't even thought about it. The opening scene of this movie, which is in the trailer, and we see John Krasinski running fervently to save his child. Well, you know why you have to run that fast? Because he's way back there. Anyway, I know that there are people who don't care about any of that, and this movie is very intense, beautifully acted.
Emily Blunt, in particular, he gives Emily Blunt some really standout scenes where she's alone with the monster as some very insane things are happening that I don't want to spoil. But then the monsters just shift from being these auditory beasts in the first and second part of the film to seeming like they have a vendetta against these people, and they're just going to wait in the house for them to make a sound, which then it just shifts into complete.
And that's not explained?
No, not at all. Not at all. Like, and it's disappointing because the film does such a good job of setting up how this whole world works in the very beginning. It's very, very smart. And it just seems to quietly place it in the recycle bin.
I do love those little reveals. But plainly, this has been going on for several years. And there's a bulletin board that he has on the wall that has all the news stories and the little things. And the camera pans. And it explains. I love that. That's very bright. Which is why all the dumb bothers me. Because you thought about all of that. And then, you know, okay.
And is this the entire world that's dealing with this? It's not
and
just
we do
this
know
family.
That. That shows up on the wall of Russia, every place. This has happened everywhere.
So you know you'd like more helicopter parenting.
And well, I'd like
no helicopters. They're going to attack
quiet
the helicopters
with silencers.
I would like to have had all the same consideration that went into the very concept itself go into would I do that? Would I do that? And if you say no and you X that off of your things that can happen in this movie, well, then you're left with nothing but things that can happen in the movie.
What did you think about the fact that they ate dinner on leaves of kale? I thought that might be too noisy.
Well, no, because the animals, the creatures themselves can walk on leaves of kale, can walk around on leaves. They wouldn't come to that. And he did the thing with the waterfall, that was so bright. And, you know, so smart. And then...
They have private conversations by the waterfall because that's the one
sense.
Place they can talk where the monsters
see how
don't
smart
hear them.
That is?
But then
let's
don't
do
you
that.
Want to
let's
ask
do that
why
all
don't
the
they build their
the
house by the waterfall?
Let's do that all the
build
way through.
Build your house by a waterfall.
You're like me, Tim. It pulls me out of the horror film when people act stupid. And I feel like why
is it really that hard to write horror films where people act intelligently? Is that just too difficult to put? Would that diffuse all the horror if people are smart?
Mr. Polanski could do it.
A Quiet Place is the film directed by John Krasinski, starring Krasinski and Emily Blunt. It's rated PG-13 in wide release. Blockers, a comedy that stars Leslie Mann, Ike Barinholtz, and John Cena. Kay Cannon is the director. Brian and Jim Kehoe, who are brothers, are the co-screenwriters. Amy?
Yeah, Blockers takes place with these three parents who you just listed, John Cena, Leslie Mann, and Ike Barinholtz, all terrifically funny, by the way. You know, John Cena, for people who have been seeing him pop up in comedy cameos, here he has a comedy centerpiece role as this steroidal-looking 1950s dad, just this exaggeration of the patriarchy, trying to prevent his teen daughter and her friends from losing their virginities on prom night. Meanwhile, you have Leslie Mann, who's just this ultra-feminine mother, running right after her daughter to try to save her from making the same mistake she did. And then Ike Barinholtz as this parental saboteur who wants his kid to party and have a good time. And he's mad that these parents might disrupt the most beautiful night of their life. You know, this comedy is, in a way, very feminist and female-powered in that it's about these young girls' right to be able to have sex on their prom night. And the girls are pretty terrific. There's one real standout. Her name is Geraldine Viswanathan, and she plays John Cena's daughter, and she's incredible. Mm,
yeah. This is just so funny. It's in the mode of these comedies, you know? And the switch, of course, is these girls are going to go out and do this thing. Of course, when I was coming up, when we were coming up, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Porky's, these were all boy comedies.
Well, these parents would have grown up in the era of American Pie. That would have been John Cena's movie.
So this goes through to one more level. What I like most about it is that these children, these particular young women, are all much brighter than their parents. Much brighter about this stuff anyway. And that's actually literally true in the world. Kids are not the same as us about this kind of stuff. You notice that teenagers don't get pregnant anymore?
They're not having much sex.
Yeah, well, you know, because they think
that
about
helps.
It. They think about it now, you know. And that's what this smart little, funny little, neat little film is all about. The last time I saw a movie that seemed to be this aware was probably like Shallow, Something About Mary, or maybe Shallow Hal.
Where it takes that twist in Something About Mary, where you realize it's about putting this girl on a pedestal and dreaming about her and not knowing who she is at all.
Yeah, and that this movie is that bright.
All right. It's bright. It's written by Kay Cannon, who did Pitch Perfect, and she directs this one as well. And she just directs this film, and she's really terrific at it. But it's a lot of lectures about these kids telling their parents, you guys do not know what you're talking about. And then also the usual bits of projectile vomiting, which I could have done without.
How funny is it?
It's pretty funny. John Cena is definitely the butt of most of the jokes, kind of literally in one scene. I liked this a lot. I really did.
I do too. I'm sorry. It's just a neat little funny little movie, I love the mix of it too. You know, I mean, we didn't mention it, but this movie's just all mixed up, black and white and Persian, and the children are all mixed breed children. It's just it doesn't comment on it, and I didn't want to comment on it because it doesn't comment on it. But since we're talking, it is, and I like that
Don't
a lot.
They know what happens when all these people start mixing. Blockers is the film. Leslie Mann, Ike Barinholtz, and John Cena star. Kay Cannon is the director. It's rated R, and it's in wide release. John Horn, the host of The Frame, spoke with the director of the film, Kay Cannon, earlier this week, and you can hear that full interview at theframe.org. Chappaquiddick, a biographical drama about the tragic car incident back in 1969 when Senator Ted Kennedy drove off of a road into a pond. Mary Jo Kopechne, who worked in his office, was killed in that incident. The film stars Jason Clarke, Kate Mara, Ed Helms. John Curran is the director, and the co-screenwriters are Taylor Allen and Andrew Logan. Tim, what do you think?
Well, this film is very much concerned with the historical details of all that happened with respect to that, which is all easy, pretty easy to go and find out. And I suppose it had to speak to those facts. But this film is also concerned with something else. And this is a choice of the filmmakers. And this is where I start to have a problem. This film is concerned with and projects itself into how Senator Edward Kennedy felt about this. And we're with him quite a lot when he's alone. We explore his angst about all of this. And I got to tell you, I don't give a damn about his
So this makes him the sympathetic
figure? Well, it gives you moments where you are intended to be to have empathy with him about this. And then it plays him as something of a conniving figure, too. But it is all of this stuff where we're supposed to have empathy. When this girl is in this river and her parents, one phone call to the mother, and maybe it happened that way. But ultimately, this film, I think, wants us to empathize most with Teddy Kennedy with respect to this. And that's not okay with me.
Well, I don't know about that. I think what it's doing is it's really poking at male privilege. And he's just this figure of male privilege. And to me, the movie feels like it's circling him and kind of jabbing him at all sides, seeing what's
if
really underneath
If we never spent
there.
The moment with him by himself where he was sad about what he did to Mary Jo, which, of course, is a projection of the filmmakers because we've, you know, if we never spent a moment like that, then I would be okay with you. That male privilege thing is all in the movie, but we spend a lot of time with him where he's all angsty and feeling bad.
Well, I'm sure he was feeling bad.
I don't know anything about how he felt, and I don't want to know. And
but
if
Tim
he did
didn't
feel bad,
care about that.
I don't care. I just don't care how he felt about it because the girls did in the river.
Yeah, but I think the film did a good job of, I mean, here I am defending this film that I don't even love that much, but he just looks like soft and shiny and sweaty. He's like veal in a polo shirt. And the film is just having him come in room and room again and kind of like slap sheriffs on the shoulder. And you see how he gets away with it by having the Kennedy name. But then you also see kind of how he's unmanned by everybody else around him. At one point, his father calls in his guys to try to resolve the situation. And you're watching how power works. And it's terrifying and it's scary. And Edward himself becomes the idiot of the family, pushed to the side. And I didn't feel that bad for him then. But I did feel bad for him in the larger scale of what is it like to be this guy, knowing that you just ruined your entire life. And I think the film doesn't take for given that he deserved this life in the first
place.
But
in fact, it didn't ruin his entire life. He became back as the lion of the Senate, got major legislation passed, was a revered figure. When he died, his legacy was touted. So it didn't destroy
his
career.
Well, it's true. And when the film has that at the very end, in the ending title cards, you feel a little bit gross that he did get all of these things, but this film picks up where he's expecting to be president.
Mm. After the death of Bobby, it starts right at the death of Bobby.
A year after, yeah. So the very first thing, it's actually kind of creepy and ghoulish to hear him say it. The very first thing he says to his best friend, played by Ed Helms, the comedian, who I thought was actually the best part of this movie, mm-hmm. is, "I'm not going to be president." That's where his brain is. And it's really cold and strange, and it feels right.
I guess to me that what's sort of the more interesting is here's a man who was so revered for his effectiveness as a senator. If you support the progressive causes that he led, and you've got this very dark, terrible thing in his personal life. I mean, that's an interesting juxtaposition. And I wonder how much of this is based on actual research into the incident, conversations that, or is this all sort of, based on a real life incident and constructed?
Well, they're marking the moments by date stamps as we work our way through this film. And it gives you the suggestion that they are trying to say this happened in this way at this time. And of course, there are the police records and things like that, the sheriff. So all of that feels very, very accounted for.
Although my impression is it is still sort of a guess because nobody knows for sure how long Mary Jo was alive in the car. And the movie has some pretty horrendous scenes where it keeps cutting back to her gasping for breath, trying to reach into the last air pockets on the roof.
And those moments, generally speaking, come when we are alone with Teddy Kennedy and he is contemplating what might have happened.
He's thinking about her.
Yeah, and feeling bad about it. And I want to stab him in the neck.
The film that we're talking about is Chappaquiddick, which takes us back to this 1969 tragic incident involving Senator Ted Kennedy and his aide Mary Jo Kopechne. Jason Clark, Kate Mara, Ed Helms star, John Curran, the director, Taylor Allen and Andrew Logan are the screenwriters. The film is rated PG-13 and it's in wide release. Coming up a little bit later this hour, we're going to take a look at the staying power of 2001, A Space Odyssey, the Stanley Kubrick breakthrough film, which was a landmark in science fiction. We're going to talk about why that film has had such dramatic power and also about its influence on other movies, despite being such a singular film itself. We'll also hear reviews of the new movies Lean on Pete, starring Charlie Plummer and Steve Buscemi, and Pandas, a new IMAX documentary at the California Science Center. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and available via podcast wherever you hear your favorite shows. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. We come your way every Saturday at noon and Fridays live at 11 here on 89.3 KPCC. I'm with critics Amy Nicholson and Tim Cogshell. Next up, the drama Lean on Pete. Charlie Plummer, Steve Buscemi, Chloe Sevigny star in the film, written and directed by Andrew High. Tim, what'd you think?
Well, this is just a beautiful meditation about a boy and his horse, which sounds like the beginning of a joke, but it's not. It's long. It's very, very slow. And it's about this young man who has this father to list when he's 16 years old. And Charlie Plummer, the young actor who plays this man, is a very slight young man. And the boy he's playing, he plays him even more fragile. He's 16 years old or 15. And I swear to God, the entire time I'm watching this movie, I'm afraid the wind is going to break this boy in half. His father's just wild, raucous, but, you know, good guy. Can't hardly keep a job and, you know, sleeps around and all this stuff. No food in the refrigerator, which is why the kid's so skinny. And the kid's just sort of like wandering around taking care of himself. But he's not a hard kid. He's a soft kid. The kind of kid, if you ask him his name, he has to think about it for a second. He managed to get himself a job working for this crusty old horse racer played by Steve Buscemi, who's just amazing in this movie. And he's not a good guy, but not a bad guy. And you know, pays the kid, but he's really hard and kind of mean to the kid. And he has this horse named Pete. And eventually this kid ends up with this horse named Pete, who's going to get sent down to the glue factory, and he runs off. And we just hang out with this boy and this horse as he tries to get to Wyoming to find his aunt, who he hasn't seen since he was a little kid. And he's just walking and talking to this horse, and I just loved every second of it.
Amy, what'd you think?
I loved it a little less. I feel like I went into Lean on Pete expecting a saccharine, pretty formulaic movie and came out with seeing something completely different, which I respected. There's a lot I like about this film mechanically, in the way that it subverts the audience's expectations. I mean, the first second you see Charlie Plummer, who people might recognize as the kidnapped grandson and all the money in the world, you're waiting for the moment when he turns to Steve Buscemi and says, "Make me a jockey." And that doesn't happen. Instead, it takes this film into really strange places where, to me, it felt almost like he was the modern millennial male incarnation of watching a Mary Pickford movie. You're just staring at him and you're so nervous about everything that's going to happen. I thought he was a little too angelic, a little too bland. I didn't really invest fully in this movie. What's almost as interesting about it to me is just the stunt casting going on here. I mean, casting Steve Buscemi as this salt of the earth horseman, casting Chloe Sevigny as his jockey, casting, you know, Steve Zahn as an alcoholic homeless man.
All completely buyable, by the way. They're just, you know, executing beautifully. And they're all...
I'm not going to say completely buyable.
Well, you don't think so? I didn't think so.
Not really, no.
Who didn't you like the most, the least? Because Steve Zahn blew me away. Didn't recognize him for a minute. Recognize him for a minute. And Chloe Sevigny, who, you know, yeah, that, and then, but then when they explained why she was a jockey, I bought the explanation for why she was a jockey, because I didn't buy her for a second either. And Steve Buscemi, yeah, he had me. He had me from start to finish.
The film is Lean on Pete. You can see it at the ArcLight Hollywood and the Landmark Theater. I'm a little surprised it's rated R. A story about a boy and his horse sounds
dark,
like
things
Flicka
happen
or something.
Oh, okay.
Actually, even having seen it, I'm still a little surprised it's rated R.
Lean on Pete in those selected theaters, rated R. The IMAX documentary Pandas takes us to the mountains of China. The film is narrated by Kristen Bell and is directed by David Douglas and Drew Feldman. Charles Solomon, what'd you think?
If there's something cuter than a baby panda, I don't think I could stand to watch it. You look at this movie and you just go, aw. And I mean, the animals are quite endangered. China has a very aggressive program to breed them and to try and reintroduce them into the wild. And there's a technique a man in New Hampshire developed to naturalize orphan black bear cubs. And that involves taking the animals for walks in the wild. They're used to you. They start to explore. They start to climb. It's an absolutely charming film. You immediately fall for the pandas. You want to just book a ticket and go and work at the reserve in China and get to play with the pandas. I once got to play with a baby orangutan and a baby chimp. And I mean, they've got nothing on the pandas. You just go and volunteer there and tumble them over and hold them and feed them. And it's just a delightful, charming film that calls attention, you know, to the plight of an animal that's losing so much of its habitat to human growth. And the Chinese are trying to prevent this and keep this iconic creature going into the next century.
Now, it has a great cast, obviously, but in terms of the filmmaking, is it a well-made doc?
Yeah, it is. They use a lot of handheld cameras, so you're following the panda as it's learning to climb, as it's learning to feed itself. At one point it gets hurt, they have to go and rescue it, and this poor Chinese biologist who's terrified of heights has to scale this vertiginous tree to coax it down, and you're right there with them.
The movie is Pandas. It's at the IMAX Theater at the California Science Center. It's rated G. The mystery thriller You Were Never Really Here stars Joaquin Phoenix, John Doman, and Alex Manette. It's written and directed by Lynn Ramsey. Amy?
Yeah, this is a very bizarre, quiet film by Lynn Ramsey, you know, the fantastic director of Marvin Caller, Ratcatcher, We Need to Talk About Kevin. It's, I suppose you could call it an art house taken, or that takes place if you accept that the world of Pizzagate is real. And you have Joaquin Phoenix as this professional murderer who's so different than any murderer you've ever seen.
A professional murderer? Someone pays him, you mean?
He gets paid to murder.
He's an assassin?
I guess. Assassin seems like a fancy word for him. He's a heavily bearded guy, doesn't do a lot of talking. You know, he's Joaquin Phoenix. He's shuffling around. He is a fascinating film creation. I mean, to have a hitman who doesn't seem to take pleasure in killing people, doesn't crack any jokes. He is very depressed about what he's doing, and he has some terrific scenes when he goes home and hangs out with his mother, who he pretends like he's stabbing as though he's Norman Bates. It's a strange film and a really strange, wonderful performance by Joaquin Phoenix, an actor who I really like a lot, and it just sort of goes on. The more he gets into the plot, the less interested I was in the film. I was really compelled by the opening beginning, which is just strange and his intentions are murky and you have no idea who he is and what he wants. And it turns out his arc towards the film gets increasingly more and more conventional. And at the end, all the pieces stack up together in a way that I kind of just shrugged. The film has this bizarre potential, but it's really worth watching for Joaquin Phoenix as this, you know, traumatized veteran who doesn't really explain what's happening. You just see scars on his body. You see tiny flashbacks to his time in the desert. And then he just barrels on with his giant beard. You know, a few things that the film also does that are interesting is like...
I would point out that half the men in this room are bearded.
It is very bloody. I should warn people about it. But then Lynn Ramsey towards the end makes these choices of cutting away from the violence. The more violence we get, the more she just shows you the after effect.
And we haven't seen Phoenix in a while, right? He's not making a lot of movies, is he?
No, he's not. And he is one of my favorite actors. I mean, you watch this in a double feature with her and you think, what range?
Yeah.
This guy's unbelievable.
You Were Never Really Here, starring Joaquin Phoenix, written and directed by Lynn Ramsey. It's rated R at the Arclight Hollywood. The Miracle Season, a biographical drama, stars Helen Hunt and William Hurt. Sean McNamara's the director. It's written by David Aaron Cohen and Alyssa Matsueda. Tim?
Yeah, biographical indeed. Sort of traditionally made in the mode of a Brian song or a Pride of the Yankees, you know, where we know how it sort of all turns out, but the sports are intended to be inspirational. And so we have that here, the loss of this young woman who was the captain of her team, in the heart of the team, and plainly a jubilant personality in her family, in her small town, her father, her mother, who at the time that she was lost was also had cancer. And not long after the loss of her, she, in fact, passed away from cancer, leaving William Hurt, her father, her team, and the team's coach, played by Helen Hunt, there. you know, to figure out what they're going to do. Previous year, they had been state champions. Things go badly. They're not winning. And inspiration. So inspiration, the name of this movie is The Miracle Season. I wish it were called The Inspirational Season, because that's what happened. They were inspired by that loss to go on and do something pretty amazing in terms of the rest of their season. In a couple of seasons after that, there's all kinds of amazing stuff that happened. And it's not even in this movie. It's more wacky than you would even think. And that's all beautiful and lovely and well done. And all of these young women are great. And it's a true story. I happen to have heard the father, the actual father, say something about it. And he loves it. So they love it. I love it. The director's the same guy who directed Soul Surfer, which is kind of, you know, this is what he does. And he knows how to do it. Good work.
The Miracle Season, rated PG. It's in wide release. Ismael's Ghosts, a French romantic drama, stars Marion Cotillard. It's directed by Arnaud Desplechin, who co-wrote the film as well. Tim, what'd you think of Ismael's Ghosts?
I like it quite a lot, and this is all extremely complicated, and we're not going to even begin to touch on it right here. It involves way more films than just this film. Right. This particular film, at the core of it, has a story about a young man named Ishmael who was married to a young woman 21 years earlier who left when he was a young filmmaker, left behind him and her father, a very famous filmmaker at the time. She's gone for 21 years. Marianne Cotillard's character. Right. The film begins. She comes back. He's involved in a relationship with Charlotte Gainsborough at this time, at this point. Right. OK, that's all happening in this movie. Don't get too caught up on it. It's not what the movie is about. Right. Okay. this movie has to do with a character called Paul Detlef. Paul Detlef first appears in a Desplechin film back in 1996, and he's in two more films, including one that came out in 2015. Right. There's another film that Desplechin made called A Christmas Story or something like that, in which this character, Ismael Vuillard, appears, right? there's another film in which Detlef's brother, Ivan, appears. Ivan appears in this film, too.
Do you need to see these prior films to know what's going on in this?
Of course you are, and you're intended to be. Now, here's the thing. You don't absolutely. This is a very powerful film. Any one of these little storylines that I just told you about could carry a movie. If you happen to have been a freak like me and seen all of this, it's so much better. So much better. So I would start with 1996 and work my way through them and land here. That's what
we have
our
homework. Yeah. Ismael's Ghost.
Sorry,
it's rated R. It's at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. The Netflix dramatic film Six Balloons is written and directed by Marja Lewis Ryan. It stars Abby Jacobson and Dave Franco. Amy?
Yeah, this is the most stressful movie that people will probably watch this week. It's about a woman who is very type A, surrounded by a bunch of people in her life who are also very type A. It opens up on a party she's preparing to throw, a surprise party for her boyfriend. And everyone's just pushing at each other, making sure it's perfect. She's looking at the pigs in a blanket her friend has just made and threatening to re-roll the dough so it's better. And then she's sent on a mission to go pick up a cake and pick up her boyfriend, pick up a cake and pick up her brother, who's played by Dave Franco. And her brother is a heroin addict with a toddler. And the night just takes this turn where it's her and her brother as she's trying to get him into rehabs, as she's trying to get him anything to get to this party before it ends, which is not going to happen. It's very fast paced. It's very tense making. Like, her phone is always ringing. She's listening to self-help tapes while Google Maps is trying to take her to various seedy directions in Los Angeles. I thought this film really captured, I suppose, the emotional tone of what it must be like to love somebody who's an addict. When you watch it from the outside, you're like, just tell your mom and everybody what's going on, but she won't. And you understand maybe what it's like to have a sibling who's screwing up so much that he still gets to be the magical one in a way because you're solving all of his problems for him and you're the one who's the problem and nobody understands the work it takes to keep this other person up.
How's Dave? Because I'm really digging Dave.
He's good. You know, he's that up-and-coming Franco, and he's a convincing heroin addict.
The rising Franco, Dave Franco, co-stars with Abby Jacobson in Six Balloons. It's streaming on Netflix. The drama is unrated. Coming up, we'll hear about the Australian Western Sweet Country and the Chinese animated film Big Fish and Begonia. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. And we're talking with our critics, Amy Nicholson, Tim Cogshell, and Charles Solomon about all the new films this week. Sweet Country is an Australian Western. Warwick Thornton, great name, directed the film. Sounds like a Western director, doesn't he? It's co-written by Stephen McGregor and David Tranter, Hamilton Morris, Sam Neill, and Brian Brown. Speaking of Australian actors, star, Tim, what do you think of Sweet Country?
Hamilton there is an Aboriginal actor, the sort of central figure in this film. And it has been in one other film, which I've seen him in which he was quite good, and he's very good in this film. The film opens. It is an Old West, sort of Aussie Old West. And he's on trial. He's on trial for having killed a white man, which, of course, was a big deal. Sam Neill and Brian Brown, right? I mean, what
takes
are you gonna
us do? Back yeah. to the Australian New Wave.
Brian Brown, he has escaped. He escapes, and Brian Brown is sent out to find him. Sam Neill is going with him. Brian Brown and his small crew are, you know, deeply racist men, as was the case back at the time. Sam Neill, not so much so. The white guy is going after the Aboriginal guy in the desert. Bad idea.
He's out of his element, yeah, so to speak.
Probably shouldn't have done that. But as I said, the film opens with him on trial. So how we get there anyway is extremely interesting. It has to do with the nature of that Aboriginal man. Look, this is an extremely brutal film that in some ways wants to account for the brutality with the way that the white Australians treated the Aboriginals. We see often when we think about that, we think about it in terms of the sort of American Westerners and Native Americans in the American Old West. It really wasn't like that at all. The Aboriginals were more like the sort of pre-Civil War slaves. They weren't slaves, but they were acquiescent and more or less served and dealt with the white men from a sort of acquiescent state. Native Americans never did that. They fought to the point of almost extinction, so it's not the same. This is a man, this one black man, decided that he didn't want to do that no more, and that's what the movie's about.
Sweet Country is the Australian Western. It's at the Landmark Theater in West L.A., rated R. Big Fish in Begonia, Chinese animated film. The movie is co-directed by Xuan Long and Chung Zhang. Charles, what'd you think?
This is a very handsome, very striking, very ambitious film from two first-time directors. They worked on the film for more than a decade, going through crowdsourcing in China and finally obtaining the wherewithal to make it. The influence of Miyazaki is very powerful in it. You have the main character, Chun, a girl who controls a certain sort of flowering tree. I think begonia is actually a mistranslation. As part of her coming of age, she has to go to Earth as a dolphin. She gets involved with a young man who drowns. She decides she has to rescue his soul, which causes all sorts of problems in her dimension or her world. I've seen it three times, both in English dub and in Mandarin with subtitles. I do not pretend to understand all of the story, but it is a very handsome film. Clearly, these are promising artists from whom we can expect interesting things in the future.
Big Fish and Begonia is the film, rated PG-13. It's at Lemley's NoHo, North Hollywood. Low Life, crime comedy, directed by Ryan Prowse, who co-wrote the screenplay with a long list of co-writers. Tim, what'd you think of Low Life?
Too much for me, man. Too much for me.
Too many writers.
Too much head bashing. It's a dark comedy, and it's meant to be funny, and it does get funny in a particular sort of way, but it involves sex trafficking and Oregon and I don't know.
It's a calling card movie. It's a movie that wants to see how weird and how wild it can get and pull it off just enough that you'll give the money to make another film. I mean, this is a movie that stars a telekinetic lucha libre fighter named El Monstro. He's got a pregnant wife. There's a gun-toting shotgun blasting hotel operator. There's a bazillion weird characters, and it kind of pulls it together. It also kind of doesn't care because it created a telekinetic Lucha Libre monster.
Low Life is unrated at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset. The Workshop, a French drama, which is directed and co-written by Laurent Conte. What'd you think, Tim?
Outstanding. They made a wonderful movie called The Class back in 2008. In some ways, this is associated with that. So this woman, a very famous French writer, is given a workshop to several young people, troubled young people, and they're going to write a story. And it's a mix of people, Arab kids and white French kids. And one kid in particular, a white French kid, is very intense. And he writes a story that's extremely disturbing and sounds a lot like one of the mass shooting stories that, you know, that actually happen in real life all the time, and it upsets everyone. At the same time, the question is, it's a story, and this is a writing workshop. What are we doing here if he can't actually write his story? Lots of very complicated things are going on in the background in his life. He's watching these videos of right-wing nationalists. And while we see him being this extremely loving brother and uncle to his small cousins, he also hangs around in the forest with his right-wing friends, putting mud on his face, firing guns at things that look like brown people. So what's going to happen? That's what the film is about. And it's very intense, very intense. I like it quite a lot.
The Workshop, French Drama at the Noir Theater in West L.A., it's unrated. Also want to mention that the Locarno Festival in Los Angeles, which is a sister festival to the one in Locarno, Switzerland, which goes back, decades. The local version at the Downtown Independent, where it opened last night, continues through the weekend. Amy, quick note of this.
Yeah, absolutely. If you want to see some foreign films that will never get distribution at all in America, they're going to be here this weekend only. It's a really great program curated by a film critic I respect a lot called Bob Kohler. Yeah, if you're an indie film, you can go and just see all of them all weekend. They all take place at the Downtown Independent. You can just back-to-back-to-back it and feel really educated.
The L.A. edition of the Locarno Festival. And Charles, I wanted to talk with you about the news that we got yesterday about the death of the co-founder of Studio Ghibli in Japan, director Isao Takahata, great filmmaker and man who really created this studio, which sets the standard in animation.
Well, yeah, Takahata was a director of extraordinary versatility. He could go from the rowdy slapstick of Pompoko to the social satire of My Neighbors, the Yamadas, to the exquisite nostalgia of Only Yesterday. But he was best known for Grave of the Fireflies, which was a movie he and Miyazaki were friends. He was about 10 years older than Miyazaki and was something of a mentor to him in the beginnings of their careers. And together they made two films that ran back-to-back in 1984. That was My Neighbor Totoro, the wonderful bucolic fantasy that we all love, and Takahata made Grave of the Fireflies, which is this just heartbreaking movie about two children surviving the destruction of Japan at the end of World War II.
It's an extraordinary film.
It is. I remember the first time I saw it was at Annecy. I had no idea what it was, just walked in because I had the free time for the screening. And I came out so tearful, I looked like a lawn sprinkler that had just been shut off. Wonderful filmmaker, very much concerned with the intimate, the poignant, the Japanese notion of mono no aware, that beauty is inherently transient and that nothing lasts forever, and nothing in his films did.
He passed away of lung cancer at the age of 82. There's a great documentary that takes you behind the scenes of Studio Ghibli in the hall, and I can't remember the name of the doc.
Kingdom of Madness, I think.
That sounds right.
The Kingdom of Madness.
And
yeah,
Takahata is a big part of that doc.
Yeah. Well, he and Miyazaki co-founded the studio, and Ghibli is a hot desert wind that blows into Italy from Africa. And they called it that because they wanted to blow a new wind into animation in Japan.
I was wondering where the name came from.
Yeah, that was where. And that was what they did. And it's a huge loss. He was a very gentle man with this melancholy smile. But his eyes were always looking around and observing people and catching just those little poignant moments that make his movies so meaningful.
And he wasn't extremely prolific as a filmmaker. Why?
It took him a long time. He was slow and painstaking and precise. And Miyazaki even would tease him about how long it takes him to make a movie. But even after he finished The Tale of Princess Kaguya, which was nominated for an Oscar a couple of years ago, he said, well, there's still things I want to do, but I'm getting to be an old man. I don't know if I'll be able to do them. But he was still making films.
And some very pointed back and forth, as you mentioned again in that documentary, The Kingdom of Dreams and Madness. The co-founder of Studio Ghibli, the great Japanese animation studio, Isao Takahata passed away yesterday at the age of 82. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we'll hear what our critics have to say about the lasting influence and power of Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. It's Ligeti's Requiem for Soprano. That's the piece that you're hearing from Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. This, the music for the scenes that show the mysterious monolith that we encounter throughout the film. 2001 A Space Odyssey, a hugely influential film. When the movie came out 50 years ago this week, critics could not stop writing about it. Audiences originally had a very split reaction to the film because it was so different than any kind of science fiction movie we'd ever seen before. Tim, let me start with you, your thoughts. What do you see as the legacy of this film?
Oh, well, there is space science fiction films before 2001 and since. It's the marker. So before, Méliès sending that rocket to the moon, the guy in the cheese, and all the goofy movies of the 50s, that's great, and then this movie. This movie, after this movie, space science films had to represent reality, the reality of traveling in space, the reality of cosmology. All of these things had to be accounted for from this point forward, no matter how wacky the film might be. And not all films have been completely as meticulous as this, but if we think about a film like The Martian, not too terribly long ago, Gravity, not too terribly long ago. No 2001, A Space Odyssey, none of those. And that's, I think, the main marker of this film. We decided that space is real, space travel is real, and it works in a certain way, and we're going to have to account for that when blast people off.
Amy, yeah.
Well, it also had the luck of coming out right when we really did go to space.
Yeah.
So we did know it was real. It was finally proven. I wonder what films Méliès would have made if he had gotten to keep making films after that. I mean, to me, what seems most relevant about 2001, what seems increasingly relevant, really, is just this battle between man and computer, between man and the how.
The AI battle.
The battle, which is as terrifying today, more so, maybe, than back then. Before, we were like, how's a problem for people who are going to the ends of the galaxy? Now, how's a problem for all of us? And when Hal begs for life at the end of the film, when he says, please, when he says, I'm scared, I feel like that's where our future is headed. And the idea that Stanley Kubrick was able to presage all of that right now is terrific.
Hold your thoughts on there. Let's listen to this scene from the film. Dr. David Bowman, played by Keir Dalea, showing some of his latest sketches to the spacecraft's operations computer, HAL 9000. It's the voice of Douglas Rain, who recently turned 90. HAL proves to be a little more analytical than was expected.
I know I've never completely freed myself of the suspicion that there are some extremely odd things about this mission. I'm sure you'll agree there's some truth in what I say.
Well, I don't know. That's a rather difficult question to answer.
You don't mind talking about it, do you, Dave?
No, not at all.
Well, certainly no one could have been unaware of the very strange stories floating around before we left. Rumors about something being dug up on the moon. I never gave these stories much credence, but particularly in view of some of the other things that have happened, I find them difficult to put out of my mind.
I can't imagine that film without Douglas Rain's voice.
Yeah, it's just iconic.
It is. It's remarkable. Charles?
Well, building for one, and first on what Tim was saying, that since then, science fiction movies have taken the technology for granted. You look at Star Wars, yeah, we go into hyperspace, this happens. Yeah, this is what something looks like, and here's the handle for it. It's not a big deal. It's part of that world. But it's a very frightening world that computers play such a critical part in. This is before we had Siri and Facebook. It was also a film that really pioneered a lot of visual effects, that there were things that were at sort of the cutting edge of technology at that time for the trip through hyperspace that we simply hadn't seen before. And yeah, in that sense, it was one of the head trip films, Mad, like Yellow Submarine. But it was also a film that stays with you. I still remember seeing it the first time as a lad and being, you know, confused but fascinating and fascinated rather than just wanting to go and see it again because it looked like the future.
One other really important part of the film, and I think we heard it in that clip, is the space, the pacing of it. There's so much time to allow you to be absorbed in the atmosphere of the film. That was very different.
Visually, and there's a lot of thinking that's going on in that movie. The names that we most often associate with this movie, of course, are Kubrick and Eisenhoff.
Clark.
I was thinking about another name, Clark, yeah. Right? I was thinking when I was researching this, and I found a note that Carl Sagan played a very big role in this movie. It was Carl Sagan that talked them, both of them, out of representing the aliens physically. In the film.
Really?
Yeah. Because they were trying to figure out, you know, what do you think aliens would look like? And Carl said, nothing that you could possibly conceive or represent, don't do it. Now, that's the cue that we didn't take from the movie because now, you know, we have giant ear monsters and whatnot. But I thought, Carl saved this movie, if you asked me, by dissuading them from that.
Although, in Clark's story that it was originally based on, The Sentinel, they never encounter the aliens. They find the pyramid on the moon. It's a pyramid down on the moon. Mm. And when they finally break it open, the concluding sentences of the story are, you know, I think we've set off an alarm and we're not going to have to wait long for the response. So, you know, but I think if that's true about Sagan, yeah. Good for him.
Yeah.
We're talking with our Film Week critics about the 50th anniversary of Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey this week. It hits the five-decade landmark, hard to believe. Upcoming Cannes Film Festival, there's going to be a special screening of a 70-millimeter print of the film as it's restruck. And I think Chris Nolan is going to be introducing it. So speaking of the influences you were talking about earlier, Tim, tribute is paid to the film. How do you see it fitting into Kubrick's other work? Tim, any thoughts?
That's an extremely interesting question. This is how I see it fits in perfectly. It's an intellectual work. So even if we think about a film like The Shining, which is a horror movie, that's an intellectual work. When you think about Kubrick's work, what lies at the base of all of it is his intellect, his thinking about it. And then whatever the genre of the film, that's what comes through. The deep, intellectual, introspective consideration of what the thing is. And that's what's in this film, and it connects it to everything he ever did.
And that's something, it seems to me, we don't see as much of in film. Films that are spectacles, big-budget kinds of films, there's less of that sort of leading with the intellect.
Yeah, I think we saw one today.
I think we saw one last week.
Well, I think also directors imitate Kubrick, including Nolan, by putting in these ponderous empty spaces, but they don't have anything to fill it with. Mm. They just make you feel like you're watching an intelligent epic. Although, I will say, I read a really funny interview this week where a writer who had spent his entire life theorizing about what it means when Dave goes to the alternate reality and he knocks over a glass as he's in the room full of himself at different ages. He knocks over this glass, he sits up and he sees an old version of himself in a bed. There's a million theories about why Kubrick did it. He finally asked the actor, and the actor said, oh, it was my idea. I just wanted a more interesting way than turning around.
We'll close on that note.
And thus I am undone.
That's Amy Nicholson, host of the Canon Podcast and regular Film Week critic with us, Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, and Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Synagogues.com. Have a terrific weekend and plenty of films for you to choose from. We remind you, in case you miss any of the program, always available, your favorite podcast source, as well as at kpcc.org. We hope you catch us next time, Saturdays at noon and Fridays at 11. Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC.